Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Caged In, the Nicolas Cage podcast, where I try and figure out, is Nick Cage the greatest actor of all time? But we're not here for that today. This is what I like to call Caged In Conversation. This is episode 8 of the series where I talk to people who have in some way been inspired or touched by the life of Nicolas Cage. Or in this case, as many of the cases of the other episodes, people who've worked with or on films that Nicolas Cage has been in. I was very fortunate to be joined by Ken Sanzel. Ken has a fantastic story from once being a cop, and he turned his sights to being a writer and director. And we kind of talk in this episode about his come up, how he made that transition, and the things that he wants to explore. We talk very much about exploring the grey areas, the moral ambiguity of characters as opposed to the black or the white. We also get into Nicolas Cage's process on a film, how professional he is, how he kind of comes ready to work when he turns up to a set, which is always great to hear, especially since I've dedicated so much time to looking at the films he's done to hear that he is a nice guy. As well as that, we go into the influences on this film. So do make sure you've either got your like notes open on your phone or a pen and paper to write down some of the films and the books that Ken mentions in this, because I for sure know that I'm definitely going to be checking out the films that he has mentioned. If you haven't seen Kill Chain, I would recommend watching it before you even listen to this interview. Unfortunately, me and Ken do get into some spoilers. We speak specifically about certain scenes and the kind of how they were put together and stuff like that. And I think like if you haven't seen the film, A, they either might not make sense entirely, or they will definitely spoil some of the second and third act moments of this film. I very much hope you do enjoy this conversation with Ken Sanzel. Please do join me at the end of the episode where I'll be talking about everything that's coming up in the next week or so and future plans for the podcast. We've got some exciting things. All that aside, there's one thing left to do, and that's to get raging with Cage. Today, I'm joined by writer and director of the 2019 crime drama Kill Chain, Ken Sanzel. How are you, Ken?
Good, good. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm not doing too bad. This might be like a weird jumping off point, but obviously it would be terrible of me to not mention, obviously, the elephant in the room that is everything that's going on in the States at the moment. How's the mood for you over there at the moment?
Angry, you know, disillusioned. You know, it's been a bad few months. I guess you define me on the left just because of where the right is. And yeah, I mean, it's a pretty fucking awful place we find the country in right now. And I think we saw it coming, but it's not any more fun to see just how willing some of our leaders are to manipulate the easily manipulated mm-hmm. into doing some pretty heinous shit. And, you know, as an ex-cop, I'm particularly outraged and incensed by what happened, you know, by people who said they are pro-cop.
That is something that like is quite interesting, because obviously when we come to talking about guilt chain, there's obviously like a moral ambiguity to characters, yeah. And at times there's obviously, you can very much look at the cop characters in that as morally bankrupt, but at the same time you can look at the quote unquote criminals and like the people who are supposed to be the bad guys as sympathetic and people that you want to root for. And like, is that something that's like baked into that script?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's baked into a lot of my work. I think because of where I come from, I'm more interested in the moral grayscale than you know, telling stories of heroes and villains. Obviously, I've made a good living working in network TV, where you do a lot of that, you know, that less interesting stuff. And in my movies and in my indie work, the stuff that's my passion, I tend to go to what my life experience was, and certainly as a cop, you know, which is that there was, you know, there were no hard lines. I mean, there certainly is evil in the world, and there are mm-hmm. people who do good, but I think that everyone gets sullied. And, you know, because this movie was specifically a noir, I wanted to do honor to the spirit of noir, which is about a sense of encroaching doom and mm-hmm. the fact that moral frailty sort of always runs you off a cliff. And even the redemption is, you know, is tainted and nuanced.
So obviously, do you mind if we like take a step back for a moment? And obviously, like you said, you used to be a cop. When did that, like, when did you go, right, I want to work in film and TV? Like, well, how did that decision come about?
I think like a lot of people, you know, I always wanted to, but mm-hmm. What happened was, I'd been writing scripts kind of on the side, you know, as a cop, you know, just as a release with no real belief it was going to go anywhere. And I had a friend, Steve Cohen, who I'd been friends with since childhood, who ended up going, he went to film school, he went out to LA, he went to work for a studio that doesn't exist anymore, Savoy Pictures, and he was reading my stuff, you know, as a good friend. Reading my awful scripts, and I think the fourth one I gave him, he liked, but nobody else did. And the fifth one I gave him, his boss liked and bought. And the way Hollywood tends to work is, once someone says you're worth giving money to, then you become validated in a way. And from there, my career sort of started and jump. And I guess it was about a year and a half or two later that I got a 3-picture deal with that same company, and that's when I stopped being a cop.
Amazing. So that would have been Scar City, Dodges City, and Lone Hero. Would that be right? Or
well, Scarred City was one of the 3 pictures mm-hmm. that I sold to Savoy, and then it ended up reverting back to me when they went out of business, and I made it. And the other two have never been made.
So that, from speaking to people, that seems to be the list of projects that never got made. Always seems to be a lot longer than the ones that tend to get made.
The movie that I made before Kill Chain, Blunt Force Trauma, I made it in 2015, and I'd written it in 2000. So you know, you never give up on them, but they do sometimes take a long and circuitous route. And sometimes they never get made.
Some
of my older ones have probably aged out of being particularly relevant anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So with a script, like you say, like Blunt Force Trauma had been on the shelf, as it were, for close to 15 years. Like, how do you go about, like, was there many updates you had to do in regards to, obviously, like, even something as basic as, like, I don't know, phones, like, do you know what I mean? Like, the technology and stuff like that has caught up so quickly. So is there just base level things you have to update like that? Or is it kind of the story is what it is and kind of tell it anyway?
It varies with Blunt Force Trauma, because basically it was smuggling in a Western, you know, mm-hmm. as this kind of modern dueling story. It didn't require a lot because it felt like it existed in its own alternate universe. And even, you know, some, you know, there are kind of scattered references to cell phone video. And I think they feathered their way in later on, you know, like as we were going into production. But, you know, it varies from story to story, you know, because a lot of the stuff I write is sort of figurative and deliberately abstract, because I'm not that interested in telling you how fingerprints work or, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, kind of technical hardware stuff. And, you know, that may be because I did so much of that in network TV. I tend to not have to update the stuff that works, and the stuff that ages out tends to age out just because the world changed. The first script that Steve liked was called Rewind. And the idea of it was that this cop kills a couple of holdup men in an ATM, and because of the way he shoots them, he ends up getting fired and sort of taking on a new identity off in the Black Sea somewhere. And the video of the killing ultimately follows him because it becomes sold as a snuff film, and he becomes a snuff film movie star. And that made sense in 1995, and nowadays that's, you know, that's TV and the internet. Yeah, it doesn't make sense anymore as, you know, something you can make money off of.
So. Yeah. Well, in 1995, if that had gone into production, that would have been like a perfect double bill with Joel Schumacher's 8mm, right? That kind of like the seedy world of snuff films.
And, you know, and interestingly, I had financing for it at one point, and because 8mm, and I think there was another snuff film movie shortly after, and either of them had done well. And so Avi Lerner was interested in doing it. I think it was Patrick Swayze wanted to do the lead, and he was like, no, you know, can you make it about something else? And I was like, it's like, can you make Star Wars not about stars, you know, not about outer space, you know, it's that kind of thing. So
obviously, yeah. You kind of touched on it slightly, but in this kind of like golden age of television, obviously, like what made you go, no, I want to still continue like making films?
I think it's, you know, I mean, and don't get me wrong, I love TV. TV's mm-hmm. been great to me. I haven't exited TV, but I came into the business loving movies. I grew up loving 70s films mostly. And then discovering 40s and 50s films and, you know, the French New Wave. And there's just something about the journey of a film that is completely satisfying. And, you know, TV, even really kind of golden age TV, with a few exceptions, you feel the way that they distend it to fill the time necessary, mm-hmm. you know, and so, yeah, there's just something. Also, I think it has to do. The reason I ended up doing well in TV was that I write quickly, and you know that's an asset in TV. But it also means that the reason I write quickly and kind of work quickly is that if I hang on something too long on a first draft, especially, I tend to turn on it. You know, I tend to doubt it, and so there's a sort of a sprint to get that first draft done, because then it's never as bad as I thought it was. And so I like with film, and especially with indie film, that there's sort of, you know, when you actually get to the starting gate, you know, Kill Chain was 3 weeks of prep, and then it was, you know, 4 weeks of shooting and 3.5 weeks of shooting, really. And it's like, you do it and you're done. And then, you know, you see what you've made. And so there's a satisfaction there. And then, you know, the things that I echo are all movies. You know, I think there's an authority to film that TV has a hard time capturing, because you don't really revisit series that often. Mm-hmm. It's a big commitment to even a miniseries to go back. Whereas movies, I mean, how often do you revisit the movies you love, you know, over and over again?
Yeah, constantly. You touched on it earlier that Blunt Force Trauma was on the shelf for a considerable amount of time. When did you first come up with the idea of Kill Chain?
Actually, what happened was when we were shooting Blunt Force Trauma in Bogota, we scouted this hotel, and it was this gorgeous colonial hotel. I think it was in La Calera, which is sort of their, I'd call it sort of the Greenwich Village-y, you know, area of Bogota. It's the part of Bogota that didn't, you know, burn during the revolutions and the fighting. And so, you know, it almost looks like Cuba. And there was this gorgeous hotel that the cinematographer took us to because we needed a couple of hostels, and we ended up not using it because it was kind of too grand, you know, too much grandeur for what I needed in that movie. And so when I got back and, you know, the producer, Gary Pressler, you know, said, look, you know, we're making a movie. The first thing, you know, the financiers are going to say is, what's next? You know, do you have something else? And we had another thing we were trying to put together, interestingly, with Nick, and he passed on it or never got to him. I don't know. But so I had the idea to write something, you know, smaller than Blunt Force Trauma, where we had been at 18 locations over 23 days. You know, we've just been all over freaking Bogota, you know, the outlying area. And I was like, let's do something contained. And so I had this idea that I would do, the original idea was three stories shot in this hotel. The notion being that you could bring in the actors for each of the stories, shoot them out in a few days or how many ever days, and then intercut everything, you know, and sort of find it in editing. So that was the initial idea. This was like right after I came back while I was still editing Blunt Force Trauma. So that's like 2015. And two of the stories worked. One was the, you know, what became the sniper story, you know, the Rico Colantoni story. And the other was a version of what becomes the Nick story, you know, which is patterned after this Raymond Chandler short story called I'll Be Waiting. That's about a hotel detective, and there's a woman sitting in the hotel, and you know, he realizes she's there to meet a gangster, and so I'd done a version of that, and then there was a third story, and it just never came together. It was just fucking awful. So a part of my, I don't know if I'm allowed to,
you can swear as much as you fucking want.
Okay. So that didn't work, and I told Gary, you know, I'm not sure I can crack this. And then about a week later, it was one of those, you know, I don't know if I was going for a walk or whatever. And I realized that what I wanted to do was take the two parts that worked and do a version of Richard Linklater's Slacker, you know, which is this movie where, you know, you start in one sort of anecdote, and then, you know, you follow one person away into a completely different story. And, you know, by the end of the movie, you're in a completely different place. So I was like, I'm going to do that, you know, but where each story ends with, you know, someone dies, and then the people, you know, the killer, we follow them to whatever happens to them. And so that got me the cop story, you know, that sort of linked it together. Yeah. And then that ended up making the Nick story, you know, obviously inform everything differently. And so that was how it all came together. And so originally it really started, the idea with, my original idea was that a Nick Cage or someone like that would be the sniper, and you think, oh, it's his movie until he dies.
Yeah.
And then it follows you to another story and another story. But, you know, once we cast Nick for the, you know, for John, or, you know, we don't give him a name, or he's Aranya. Once we cast him as Aranya, then the producers were like, well, he has to be at the beginning too. And so I created that sort of framing sequence, which is pretty nakedly paraphrasing the beginning of The Killers, you know, the Robert Siodmak, I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, the Burt Lancaster movie.
Yeah.
You know, which is based on the Hemingway story, where the two killers go into the diner looking to kill that guy.
So there's a particular scene I wanted to talk about, and it really stuck out to me, because I was like, in all of the films I've ever watched, I've never really seen like a shootout in a car. Like in the way, was that something again that was in the script, or was it something that kind of like through budget constraints or something like that you thought like that shootout needs to happen there? Because it's a really inventive and kind of tense moment in the film.
No, thanks. No, that was, like I said, that was part of the story that I cracked once I got to the slacker format.
Yeah.
And I'd always wanted to do that gunfight because I love Takeshi Kitano. Mm-hmm. He did sort of that at the end of Fireworks, you know, but it's very quick, you know, it's a very kind of short thing. And he also does a shootout in an elevator. I think that's in Sonatine. And so I love the idea of doing that gunfight in an impossibly small space,
yeah.
You know, and dealing with the fact that people miss a lot. And, and this is kind of a firsthand experience. I was actually, when I was a cop, I was in a shootout on a train and, you know, bullets miss, you know,
yeah.
You know, shit. And, you know, we were all within 7 feet of each other. And so I like the idea of, you know, when I constructed that whole sequence, that it's like building this tension, you know, obviously it's about Eddie's character fomenting this mistrust between the two guys. And then once the one guy shuts him up, killing him, you know, that you just keep on cresting that mm-hmm. violence to where it explodes. But because, you know, one guy's driving, so he's got control and the other guy, you know, shooting. And, you know, I just like the chaos of it. And then, you know, and then when it landed, it became a little more of sort of a Coen Brothers feeling, you know, of the two of them playing cat and mouse. And, you know, what I thought, Eddie did a, you know, killer job being a dead body, which was, you know, remarkably, it was interesting because he's just as much a character, in that sequence once he's dead, you know, so that was all designed.
So,
and also, I'm sorry,
just
to go to your point about budget, you know, the flip side of that is that, you know, driving stuff is really time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew I wanted to do Poor Man's Process, which is a lot faster. And once I did that, the way that Manuel, the DP kind of designed it, it created this, you know, this beautiful, again, you know, surrealism, this kind of alternate reality where you're not feeling literally headlights, you know, it's a lot of, you know, kind of colors and, you know, abstract patterns against the grates and stuff. And so, you know, that kind of elevated, you know, what did start, you know, partly a necessity that I knew I was going to have to do at Poor Man's. I wasn't going to be doing these guys driving and shooting.
Well, there's a really interesting thing because the whole film and obviously like the way that shot and like the kind of, I would almost call it like a surrealist haze to it. It feels like the type of story that Nick's character would be telling someone who's come to the hotel. And it's like, that it's a film that like, obviously over the last 4 years, I've gone through and kind of talked about every single Nick Cage film, obviously pretty well. There's a lot of them. And it's like around, especially around this period, it's a real roll of the dice. And I like to kind of go in without any expectations and stuff like that. And I like, well, I wouldn't be speaking to you otherwise, but I absolutely loved this film. And I think, like, again, like you mentioned Slacker and the kind of like, it's a film I've never seen, but the kind of the way this film, the way it all plays out and the kind of reference points, to noir and even the super like violent way that one of the assassins gets killed at the end and stuff like that. It kind of like just ticked all the boxes of stuff that like I really enjoy. And so at what stage did Nick come on board to the project? Was it a case of you had an idea that you would want him since the last project like that failed, or was it kind of send it out, see who we get?
It was kind of in between, you know. I think we were a little skeptical about getting Nick because, you know, he passed on the other thing. But Gary and Eric, the producers, also had a relationship now with Nick's manager and, you know, with sort of his world. And when they broached the idea of this script, they said, you know, this sounds like something Nick might be interested in. And again, I thought he was probably more likely to take the Rico part, but he, you know, he took to, you know, the lead, which was fantastic. And so, yeah, it really was as prosaic as, you know, let's take another shot at Nick with this because we know the manager now and they say it's something he might be interested in. And Nick responded to it, you know, I mean, that which was fabulous, you know, and the thing that's interesting with Nick is I think, you know, he locks into, he doesn't necessarily lock into the prosaic reasons that he might do a piece. You know, he had very, you know, he was already in some ways deeper inside the character than I had written him by the time, you know, by the time he came back around to me, you know, it had clicked for him as, you know, I think he probably liked the way it was written. You know, he liked the world, but mostly he liked what he saw in Aranya. That was, you know, he called it sort of Peter Parker and Spider-Man, you know, that it's a guy playing a role, you know, and I think also the fact that it, you know, it's different, you know, I think he doesn't like to do the same stuff over and over again. I think that's why, you know, he does so many movies, is that he likes to do different stuff, you know, and doing these short, you know, small movies allows him, you know, to step into a lot of different skins and, you know, play different characters. He also really draws a lot, you know, from actors and performances that interest him, you know, which was a fun ride. You know, it was a fun ride because he watches a lot of movies you know, you kind of, it's a challenge to find movies he hasn't seen and, you know, go back and forth and find reference points that, you know, intrigue him.
So for a film like this, obviously, you hear of directors giving their cast a kind of list of films to potentially watch or anything like that. Was there anything that you kind of gave to Nick for this to say, like, maybe check out this and kind of get a feel for what I'm going for?
Well, we talked about Charles Bronson early. Mm-hmm. And then he talked about this movie Harakiri, this samurai movie I'd never seen that had some interesting, you know, parallels in structure to Aranya in terms of the way he sort of hides his past from the people he's confronting, and, you know, and where their past, you know, underlines his. And then I showed him this movie, Hickey and Boggs, that Robert Culp directed, you know, after I Spy, which I think is one of the great 70s noirs, you know, kind of unheralded, fucking hard as nails, and just, you know, kind of does all the things I love about noir and does all the things I love about 70s movies, you know, beautifully. And he really got interested in Robert Culp. And I think, you see some Culp and you see a lot of Toshirô Mifune and, you know, kind of how he ultimately approaches the character. So that was a big one. And then I gave him the short story I was telling you, I'll Be Waiting. And then I gave him, which he also read, the novel Fast One by Paul Kane, which I think is the greatest pulp book ever written. Kind of distills everything about pulp down into, you know, a couple hundred pages.
Amazing. You're giving me such a wealth of things that I need to kind of like catch up on. I'm kind of like currently in the moment a bit of like a 70s binge after reading Easy Rider's Raging Bulls. So like I'm kind of like hearing about the cult film and stuff like that. It's another one to go on the ever increasing list I've got. I just wanted to get your opinion on, because obviously you've worked with Nicolas Cage and you've worked with Mickey Rourke in Blunt Force Trauma, and I think both of those actors kind of get like a bit of a short shrift from most people. And I personally think unfairly. When you come to approaching these like actors and stuff like that, what is it about them? Because obviously they come with this weight of public opinion and kind of what, like, I don't know, an air of who they are to the public. Does that factor into to when you cast people, or is it just like, no, this is the right person for that role?
It's a little tricky because when you're doing, you know, these very small indie movies, a lot of it is about producers who go to financiers and say, here's a list of people that will justify the movie at this mm-hmm. price point. And, you know, the list of people gets smaller even as the price point gets smaller, because the, you know, the profit margins on these kind of movies are narrow. You know, they're surprisingly narrow sometimes. So, you know, I kind of, what tends to happen is that, you know, Gary will throw names at me and I'll say, well, you know, either I can get my head around it or I can't. and, you know, beyond that, you know, you definitely, like, Nick didn't have any kind of reputation coming in terms of, you know, all I'd heard was that he was great to work with, you know, and I talked to the director who'd done the movie before mine, who had nothing but great stuff to say about him. You know, it's like, so there wasn't that sometimes leeriness. I mean, I've dealt with more in TV than features, really, but, you know, once in features too, you know, sometimes you deal with really horrific actors and they, you know, they can derail you, especially when you're, you know, every day you're chasing time, you know, mm-hmm. you're not going to get extra days. You're not going to get reshoots. And so you get nervous about, you know, about who's going to show up on set and whether they're going to honor the amount of time that you have. And I guess because Nick does these so often, he's really the opposite. I mean, he showed up in Bogota the first day and he had the script memorized.
Yeah.
I mean, line for line, like, you know, kind of old school Shakespearean actor, you know, came in and just knew everything, you know, literally walked, you know, he said, hey, you want to run lines? And we went over to the bar and he ran the whole fucking movie off book. So, you know, and he said, you know, and then we ran it again with Annabelle, the woman in red, and she was unnerved because she wasn't off book. And he said, look, you know, I used to do this, you know, like you know, I learned it as I went along. He said, but I find that because these movies, you know, there's such a short amount of time, I come just ready to go. You know, I come prepared. And he was just, I mean, which even so, you know, I would see him sometimes down at the bar, you know, what we call the aria, you know, his big speech at the end where he basically tells the whole story. And he would walk through every detail about where he was going to light a match, about, you know, how he was going to write information on the napkin or the bar coaster. It's like, you know, nothing wasn't, you know, very kind of carefully premeditated for him, which, you know, he left himself open to messing around with stuff. But he also, you know, he was just kind of super prepared and, you know, and respected the time, you know, that you have. So yeah, you know, I mean, I guess that ran far afield of your story, but you know, Nick is a fucking icon. I was like, you know, I should be so lucky as to have Nick Cage in a movie, you know, short shrift or not by others.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So obviously 2020 was a very weird year in regards to the world and especially film. But as we start to wrap things up, what does the future look like for you in regards to future projects or anything like that? I know a lot of the time you can't really, it's hard to talk about or anything like that, or what's on the horizon for you, Ken?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not that I can't talk about stuff, but I am very superstitious, because, you know, you talk about something and then invariably it doesn't happen so that everyone can ask you what happened with it. I do have you know, two more kind of similar sized projects to Kill Chain and Blunt Force that I'm working with Gary on. You know, one of them, I think we have the money, but it's conditional on cast. And so it's about, you know, trying to find a window. Nick was attached actually to do it. But then, you know, 2020 happened and everything sort of fell apart, you know, I don't know if we'll find, you know, with Nick, a lot of times it's about finding a window. So,
yeah,
you know, we'll probably, you know, I don't know if, you know, Nick's going to be that, but I have, you know, I have a project with Gary then, and, you know, I'm writing another feature, and then, you know, in TV tends to be for me a little bit looser, you know, it's like mm-hmm. stuff comes to me because of my background, because I know how to run a show, and they sort of, you know, I take what comes my way and figure out if I want to do it.
Perfect. Well, before I let you go, I just wanted to kind of like briefly touch on the thing that Matt, like, this isn't a slight to certain directors, but like what you managed to contain in Nick Cage, obviously, like he's known to kind of like go off on these wild dalliances of performances, and like what I noticed in Kill Chain is that his character has this perfect, like, it's like knowing that menace and anger is there, but it seems to be just like bubbling under the surface of the character, and I feel like in other directors' hands that can kind of like, I don't know, to me Nick Cage seems like somebody who in the wrong hands can kind of like not be like utilized for what he can do. And like, yeah, just like as a fan of the movie and as a fan of Nick's, like, just wanted to kind of say thanks for kind of like, I don't know, creating something that like really plays to the strengths of what Nick can do.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I do get a lot of, you know, I saw on the internet a lot of people bitching about the fact that he doesn't, you know, do the big Nick Cage thing. But, and I'd love to say that it's genius on my part. I think it, you know, it wasn't in the script, you know, this wasn't that story. And, you know, the things that attracted Nick to it weren't, oh, I'm going to get a chance to
wig out,
to do this big explosive thing. You know, it's like the movie has sort of, his character especially has a kind of dry, dark humor to him, and you know, he played to that. He played the sort of the absurdities of some of the moments, but you know, there really wasn't any place where it called for him to explode. And I don't think even in a lot of those movies, I mean, I think you know like anything else, you know, you do a bunch of movies and some of them are better than others, and you know, it's true for all of us. In TV we always say, you don't have 22 best episodes of the season. You know, it's like, just, you know, some things work out differently and not always in ways that you can predict. I think that, you know, I think that he tends to do what he thinks, you know, is organic to that script. So in some places it's just, you know, I mean, yeah, some of the movies I don't get as much as others. But, you know, for me, it was just, you know, there was definitely a delineated path that the character went down, and, you know, he played it magnificently, but he didn't say, oh, well, I'm going to wander off into the woods and do some other shit. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think for the kind of true Cage fans, there's enough Cage-isms in there, kind of like lined
up. Oh, yeah.
There's like the people kind of deriding it for the no, like, freak out moments. I don't think a kind of, really well versed in the kind of many layers of what Nick Cage can do, and I think this is it's a great film.
Well, thanks. I mean, yeah, I mean, sitting and editing, it was the little shit that just amazed me. There's the moment when he says something to the killer about, you know, to have gone all this way and not, you know, not hear the point of the story, and he just throws his eyes to Ali Me. And it's just this little thing, and it's so Nick, and it's just, you know, it's in that micro, it's in that detail. Yeah. And, you know, that's the shit that I love. Yeah. I mean, that's the shit that, you know, movies, you know, have that chance to go to those kind of granular moments. You know, TV doesn't always, you know, TV really is a lot of pushing story along. So.
Definitely. Well, Ken, thank you so much for your time. And if people want to keep up to date with what's coming in the future and stuff like that, where can they follow you on social media? You're on social media, right? Well, I know for a fact you are.
Yeah. I mean, I'm on Twitter, you know, tend to be more political than, you know, stuff coming up, self-promotional.
Well, that's what we need right now. We need some politics, right? We need people. We need people calling these dickheads, Ken.
Yeah. No. So, yeah, don't go there if you don't want to see a lot of angry left of center stuff. I'm not really great about self-promoting. I guess IMDb, you know, tends to be
perfect.
When stuff actually becomes relevant, that's where it shows up.
Amazing. Well, again, thank you so much for your time, Ken, and coming and raging with Cage.
Thank you.
There we go. Again, thank you very much to Ken Sanzel for his time coming and raging with Cage with us. That was a great conversation, right, guys? If you feel the same, if you feel differently about any of the films I ever discuss on this podcast, please do not hesitate to get in touch, which you can do on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, all at CagedInPod. You can always drop an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. You can support the podcast by going to Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever you're listening to this podcast now, giving it a 5-star rating and review. I am told all of that stuff really helps to boost this up the charts, as well as subscribing. So make sure you hit that subscribe button so you get the episodes as and when they drop. If you would like kind of teasers as to what is coming up film wise on the podcast, or kind of what I've been watching in research for the podcast, adds another little extra layer to everything that's going on. You can find me on Letterboxd, which is again Caged In Pod. And if you would like to support the podcast financially, you can always do that via Patreon, which is patreon.com/cagedinpod, or you can go to cagedinpodcast.limitedrun.com to pick up one of the fantastic Tim Hornsby Caged In Superman prints. And soon the pre-order link is imminent to get the Caged In Wicker Man t-shirt, which the colorway has been decided. It's going to be a nice tan colored t-shirt with a kind of burnt orange design on it, like the ink. And Tim Sinclair has done an amazing print. If you're not following on the socials, head on over to all of that to make sure you get to see this amazing design. And if you're listening to the design, might be final. I kind of tossed and turned with a couple of different designs. There's either kind of like a small print on the front and like a big print on the back, but a lot of people seem to be digging the big print on the front, and once you see it, you'll understand exactly why. So obviously be sure to keep an eye out for that. Obviously I'll be dropping stuff in the show notes as soon as that is live. As for next week's episode, we'll be back on chart with just a regular episode next Wednesday, and I will be joined by musician and podcaster Mike West to talk about the 2019 action movie Primal. So do be sure to come and check out that one. Again, subscribe so you get it the day it drops. I also have a few more bonus episodes that I'll be dropping, probably again on a Friday basis. I've got an amazing conversation with Marianne Zumberg all about her top 5 and bottom 5 Nick Cage movies, as last year she did a full, like, 97 Cage films in a year. So had an amazing conversation with her, and I've got an amazing conversation with Kevin Frolix, who has written Vampire's Kiss the musical. So do keep your eyes and ears out for all of that stuff. I'll be announcing it on social media, as well as letting you guys know on here when they are going to drop. So as always, guys, I've been Petrus Patsalidis. I've been Caged In. You've been amazing. Bye bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more. Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drip Town Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.